You're listening to Nick Luck Daily, bringing you the latest news and the best interviews from around the world of horse racing. This episode is brought to you by the Racehorse Owners Association, by Thoroughbred Racing Commentary's Global Rankings in partnership with the Saudi Cup, and by the Fitzdares Club. Good morning, it is Tuesday, April the 20th. Tributes have continued to pour in for amateur rider Lorna Brooke, who died the day before yesterday, 10 days after her fall in a chase at Taunton. Clearly, she was somebody who spread an awful lot of joy and love, and that joy and love echoed her own delight in the sport of racing. She clearly will be very much missed, and another heartfelt tribute to her comes from Fergal O'Brien, who I'm interviewing a little later in this podcast, on reaching his 100th winner of the season, a really notable milestone for him and his team. And he's not the only O'Brien on today's show. In just a few moments' time, I'll be talking to Joseph about Thunder Moon, one of the key fancies for the 2000 Guineas. A brilliant winner of the National Stakes last year, third in the Dewhurst. How's he coming on, and how's Pretty Gorgeous, 1000 Guineas fancy coming on? I'll be talking to the trainer. And at the end of this episode, please do stay tuned for what I think is one of the most engaging interviews so far in our Weatherby's Round the Bloodstock World Series, this time with Indian breeder Amita Mehra, who has achieved something quite extraordinary, both professionally and personally. First, though, Lee Mottishead from the Racing Post is with me. And Lee, we've got an awful lot to get through today, particularly quickly, because you are off to Epsom for their opening fixture of the season, and it is Epsom with a bit of a difference.
It will, Nick. It was looking different last night, Nick. I did a 10K run yesterday, from which I pulled up a little bit early with a sore knee, but not until I got to the Downs, which were already partly fenced off, because this will be like Derby Day last year, whereby the Downs are an open space. And obviously, in on a behind-closed-doors race meeting, that can be difficult to manage. So the Downs are being fenced off. They'll be fenced off for 24 hours. The race course itself looked magnificent. And as you say, it's always exciting to get to Epsom for the first time. We haven't seen racing there since Derby Day last year. And we go there with a Derby trial to look forward to. The rest of the card is disappointing. The City and Suburban Handicap isn't a bad race this year, but it is it's an historic handicap, as is the Great Met. And it's a real shame to see that with only five runners and 11.5 grand in prize money. Obviously, there are reasons why that will be the case this year, certainly prize money, but the field size is disappointing. But the trial, the Derby trial, the Blue Ribbon, looks a fascinating contest, and all the more fascinating, Nick, having listened to the pod yesterday and heard what Andrew Burt Black was saying about his horse, Uncle Bryn. I was watching his two races last night again. His first win at Kempton is extraordinary because he's as green as grass and comes from a hopeless position to win. Look much more clued up at Wolverhampton next time. And if you look at the anti-post Derby betting, it looks very much like the scoreboard at the end of the Cheltenham Festival. It's all Ireland. It's Aidan O'Brien with a bit of Jim Bolger thrown in. Uncle Bryn is the highest or the shortest priced British candidate so far for the Kazoo Derby. And it would be great to see him produce a big performance today. And I think he very well might.
Well, Lee, of course you can't keep an O'Brien out of classic action, whether it's the Derby or the Guineas. Guineas more immediately, and we've been speaking about that race so much through the last week on this podcast, with relatively few mentions of Thunder Moon, who is second or third favourite, 13-2, 7-1, National Stakes winner last year, trained by Joseph O'Brien. I popped in a call to him this morning to find out how he was getting on.
Hi, Nick. Yeah, he's wintered very well. Obviously, we put him away after the Dewhurst. We were very pleased with his run there. The ground went a bit slow on us, and we probably weren't drawn in a perfect position, but still thought it was a very, very good run. And you know, the plan has been to all winter to, you know, either go straight to the Guineas or have a prep, and you know, we opted to go straight there. So he's in good shape.
Yeah, I know I'm not the only one. I'm a bit of a sucker for a horse who will just show a flash of brilliance wherever it is and over whatever trip. Would you agree that he did that more than any horse in the National Stakes last year?
Yeah, I think it was a very good performance. Very messy race, and he really got himself out of trouble, and showed a fantastic turn of foot and speed are probably his two attributes. He'd love a bit of firm ground, and he's a strong traveller, and like I say, has a big turn of foot, and he showed that a couple of times last season.
And you're the one person who doesn't want it to rain, basically, between now and Guineas Day.
Yeah, absolutely, Nick. It would be pretty important to us that the ground was, you know, at least good or better. It's going to be hopefully we have a long season. So we'll see what conditions are like. But yeah, we would feel that good or better ground would be important to us.
Okay, so it's a tough question, but the two horses who finished in front of him in the Dewhurst, you'd be well familiar with, St Mark's Basilica and Wembley, who are both trained in Ballydoyle. Do you think Thunder Rock is a fundamentally classier horse than they are?
Well, I don't know about classier. I probably feel that we're probably the quickest horse. We travelled very well through the Dewhurst. We travelled down to the furlong and a half. And looked the winner from on the day. There was quite a severe bias towards that stand side at Newmarket, and we were drawn on the other side, and the ground was also obviously on the slow side. So I thought it was a fantastic run. You're always frustrated when you don't win, but when we broke down the race and looked at it afterwards, we were very proud of his run, and we were looking forward to taking them on again in the Guineas in what, you know, we hope will be quicker going.
Pedigree suggests he'll stay a mile. You've seen enough milers, you've seen enough sprinters. What is he?
Yeah, I think, like, even his pedigree suggests he should stay a bit further. He's out of a saddle as well as mare. We had a couple of Fast Net Rough brothers that both went 10 furlongs and one of them went 12. So I'm quite confident of a mile. To be honest, I'm not sure how much further than that he's going to go, because he is quite a pacey horse. But I'm really hopeful that a mile will be within his range.
And who's going to ride him this season?
I'd say Declan McDonagh is most likely to ride him in Newmarket and go from there, but it hasn't really been discussed yet now in any detail, but I'd imagine Declan would ride him. He has a good relationship with him, and he rides for us plenty, so I'd imagine he'd be the most likely one to sit on.
And Pretty Gorgeous is about the same price for the 1,000 guineas. Is she coming along okay?
Yep, she's in good shape too. Pleased with how she's wintered. She's a big, powerful mare, and the plan is to go straight there also. I'm very happy with her, Nick.
Joseph O'Brien there, Lee Mottishead still with me. Lee, I always think that when you hear about one of last season's top juveniles, it reminds you to temper your enthusiasm about what you've seen in the last week.
We're on the same wavelength here, Nick, because I was looking at the 2,000 guineas last night, and I've been umming and ahhing about whether to back Thunder Moon for a while. In the end, I did. Silly, really, because he was 8-1 a couple of days ago. Best price was 7-1 last night. But he just looks like he could be the one. I thought his performance in the National Stakes was tremendously exciting. I was prepared to forgive him his run in the Dewhurst, where I thought he travelled like the best horse in the race. And if you look at the weather at the moment, and you look at the weather forecast, and you remember what people were saying about the ground at the Craven meeting, you'd think we're in for a proper good to fast ground guineas. And he seems to me to be the one that potentially has the brilliance in the field. I think both classics, as I put in my column on Monday, have a very odd shape to them, in the sense that you've got, with the 2,000 guineas, a horse heading the market, One Ruler, who hasn't run since finishing second in the Vatem Futurity Trophy, after which you could still back him for quite some time at 25-1. And now he's a shorter 7-2 without having done a thing since then. And you've got a 1,000 guineas market headed by a filly who has run once, won a Curragh Maiden last back end, and is 7-4, having been 33-1 for the guineas after that Curragh Maiden. They've got a very interesting shape to them. And in some ways, what we haven't got at the minute are any obvious superstars, save potentially for Santa Barbara, if all the hype is right. And hopefully what look interesting but strange guineas will produce really exciting winners to take us forward into the summer.
Well, jump season drawing to a close, there are lots of personal landmarks that have been achieved in the last week or so. And one very important to Fergal O'Brien is that he got the 100 up last night and he joins me now. Well done, Fergal. That's quite an achievement, particularly with a couple of months of the season sliced off. How are the team feeling this morning?
They're all great and you know, very, very lucky to have such a great team of people. You know, I've always said, just a small cog in a very big wheel, and you know, it needs all of them to work very hard as well. You know, they do the day in, day out graft, and you know, I'm the lucky one to get to speak to you.
And there are relatively few trainers who operate, if you like, all season round. I remember speaking to you at Stratford last June or July when you were, you know, well in front in the trainers table. You got off to a good start and you finished strong as well.
Yeah, I've been very lucky. Look, I've always said I feel very privileged to do what we do. I just love jump racing, and it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, July, August, November, wherever, you know, a winner to us, it just means everything. It's what we do, it's what we get up in the morning for. And, you know, the Hunter Chase winner at Stratford the other night with Albie Tuffin and all, just meant the world to us. You know, it got us one closer, obviously, to the 100, but it just means so much to everyone. It's just what we love doing, yeah.
You mentioned Albie Tuffnell. You've done well with all sorts of jockeys this season. Max Kendrick's ridden 14 winners for you, which is a fantastic haul for him. But no one has ridden more winners than Paddy Brennan, your great right hand, if you like. 63 winners for you he's ridden this season. He described himself as in the autumn of his career the other day. I don't think the leaves are turning brown just yet, are they?
No, they're certainly not. No, and he's, look, the fact that the likes of Albie, Max, Liam, and Connor, they're all there. We've got another really good lad, but he's only had two rides with Tom Broughton, who's a fantastic school and jockey. And you know, Paddy sort of sits above all of these, and not in a condescending way, but he guides them and he tries to put them on the right track. And he's so good with the younger lads, and you know, he's just a real great example. You know, he works very hard, he still works, goes to the gym, he runs the tracks, he's dedicated, he's in three mornings a week, and you know, he's just phenomenal, really. And you know, without, you know, there's lots of people without him wouldn't have been done, but Paddy Brennan is definitely right up there. If it wasn't for Paddy, just it wouldn't have been achievable.
Now, you have yelled home each and every one of those 100 winners. I've seen most of them with my own eyes. Is there one that has given you particular satisfaction for whatever reason?
You know, the Stratford winner, Jim Collip was with me from my point to point days. Sally actually rode Bradley for him to win the Royal Artillery Gold Cup, so you know, that's sort of the first connection I had with Sally, and Sally's obviously a massive part of what we do. So I suppose, Jim, and lovely for Albie. You know, Albie's family's been through a bit of a tough time. Albie lost his brother about 6 weeks ago, and it was just great for them, because without Jane Tuffnell as well, Jane was the one who introduced us to Rupert and Nicky Lowe, who got us to Ravenswell Farm. So I suppose, you know, ironically enough, it's a Hunter Chase winner where I started. You know, I'm wiser now, would be a standout for me.
And it really has struck me that you've done incredibly well maximising the return for your owners at whatever level. And I was just looking at the Great British Bonus table the other day, and I noticed you'd won, I think, five of those.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great initiative, and you know, I think they're giving out over £2 million worth in prize money, and which is a phenomenal thing to do, and it definitely does encourage people when you go to the sales to say, you know, this one is GBB registered, and we can do something here. You know, it's fantastic.
And Fergal, before I let you go, I know there's something you wanted to add.
Take a minute of your time. I just want to mention Lorna Brooke, who I've known Lorna since she was 17 and started pointing, and she's a huge loss to the amateur ranks and to the racing community.
Fergal O'Brien there, and concluding that interview with a tribute to Lorna Brooke. And Lee, the tributes have continued to flow during the last 24 hours. Just clearly a lovely human being.
Yeah, absolutely, Nick. Sometimes when someone dies and you read all the tributes to them, you just wish you had known them. And I didn't know Lorna. She wasn't someone who'd been greatly on my radar, truth be told, until she suffered that terrible accident. But I was looking back through some of her wins yesterday, Nick, for a piece in the Racing Post. And what struck me was when you watched her winning on horses like Spock, for her mother and other wins too, is what joy she took from it. Her face after those wins, particularly say on looking at races on Spock at Hereford and at Fontwell, and there you have those camera shots that pan on the jockey after the race, and she just wore the broadest smile. And I looked at her and I sort of thought, well, this is desperately, desperately sad. But if there's any comfort, is that what joy she took from what she did in horse racing. And her life has ended horribly early, but it seemed like it was a life well lived. She seemed like she got the most enormous pleasure from race riding. And it's therefore tragic that it's race riding that took her life. But again, look at those videos and you see a lady who was just filled with joy in those moments. And I hope when the family and her loved ones look back on those videos, they will take some comfort from that.
And Fergal O'Brien there, once again, stressing the importance to National Hunt Racing of the amateur branch of the sport. Lee, as to his own achievement, getting to 100 winners in a season, that's quite something.
When you look at his career progress in a relatively short space of time, and the way his graph looks in terms of the blocks getting bigger and bigger from last season, having had 63 winners in what was a season truncated at the end, to this season having 100 winners in a season that was more heavily truncated at the start, it's an extraordinary achievement. And again, it's an example, I think, of someone who has got to their position really through talent. And that's not meant to be dismissive of other people, but horse racing is a sport in which there's quite a lot of nepotism. And that's not, again, to dismiss those people, because the sons and daughters of individuals, of trainers, are often enormously talented in themselves, and that their success becomes because they are talented, but they clearly get a helping hand. And I think Fergal has come a different path, and I think that makes his achievement extremely laudable.
But he is only the second most famous O'Brien on today's podcast.
I think he'd agree with that.
And there is still good jumping to come, Lee. Sandown, Punchestown. Sandown this weekend could throw up a couple of nice surprises, especially that two-mile chase.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it could be a belting card at Sandown on Saturday, Nick. Just going to the three big races in their order of appearance, we could see Tiger Roll in the Oaksy Chase, presumably his connections wanting to provide more evidence to Martin Greenwood that the horse actually should be running in selling chases at Plumpton, not receiving big weights in the Grand National. But Frodon's in that race as well, and hopefully we might see Briony Frost back on him there. Then the jewel, what will be on this card, because the Bet365 Celebration Chase looks an absolute humdinger. Possibly a race that could be even more interesting than the Champion Chase, whose winner, Put the Kettle On, is entered. I imagine she's also under consideration for the corresponding race at Punchestown, but she has such a good record in Britain under Aidan Coleman that I suspect she'll go to Sandown, a track that really should suit her well. We've got Nube Negra, who she just touched off in the Champion Chase and was arguably unlucky. Now, they are at the head of the betting, along with a certain horse called Altior, who didn't make the Champion Chase, but apparently still does exist, according to Nicky Henderson, who was making that point this morning again, that he's definitely around still, Altior, still burning up the gallop, still putting in electric schooling sessions. But let's hope he gets there. That should be a cracker. And then the Bet365 Gold Cup, the last great contest of the jump season. It's a race that, a bit like the Great Met on the Flat, it's been slightly in the doldrums. It's not the race of old, but I really hope for the race that Clan des Oboes goes, because he would add tremendous spice. And we should say as well, Nick, in the following race, the Select Hurdle, we might well see Goshen, which would be fascinating too. So could be a tremendous send-off to the season in Britain on Saturday. And then, as you referenced, we've got a wonderful Punchestown Festival next week.
Go back to episode 48 of this podcast, Lee, and you'll find a long interview with John Dance saying how he was sort of stepping away from the sport for a number of reasons. He's back, and he's back with a bang.
Yeah, Absolutely, yeah. Talk of his exit from the sport has been very premature. He gave reasons for wanting to scale back, and I think reading what he said in the Post and elsewhere today, I think he doesn't regret having done so. But in effect, it looks like he's trying to do what Andrew Black has done alongside Michael Owen and create his own racing operation in Middleham with James Horton, Sir Michael Stout's long-time assistant, as his trainer there. Really fascinating development. John is a character, very passionate about the sport, a bit like Charlie Mann. He can sometimes come out with an explosive comment, but you know how much he loves horse racing. I think in some ways this might be a sensible move, because if you are looking to have a significant interest in the sport, it's a very expensive business. And at least once you've created the operation, you can probably manage costs better if you're running your own operation from your own setup. So I think it could well be a sensible move. And horse racing always needs big players to compete against the superpowers in the sport. And if John Darnes can further develop his standing in the sport, that'd be great for flat racing.
Well, it is Tuesday, so it is the day where we go around the bloodstock world. In association with our colleagues at Weatherby's, their stallion book and their excellent Global Stallions app. And I'm very pleased now for the first time in this segment to head to India, to Pataudi in Haryana, about 100 Ks from Delhi, to the Usha Stud Farm, owned by Amita Mehra, who's also the chief executive. And Amita joins me now. Amita, thank you for talking to me today. Perhaps we could start, you could just tell us a little bit about the history of this very storied stud farm.
The stud farm started in 1973. My father, who was then in the army, Major P.K. Mehra, he was the commandant of the president's bodyguard. He began the stud farm while he was in the army with one stallion, which he imported from England, called Grey Gaston, and two mares that he actually brought on ship in those days, traveled with the mares himself. And he started in the backyard of his cantonment home. That's how the farm started, and the first few foals that he produced, one of them won the Indian Derby, and that's how he went from rags to riches, so to speak. So he had the fillip to begin the farm, take premature retirement, and that's how the Usha Stud Farm story began.
And what had sparked his initial interest and love and passion for the thoroughbred?
Well, he was actually a horseman. He was in the 61st Cavalry, and then he was playing polo. He was the captain of the Indian team. He had played polo in England. In fact, there was a story just yesterday in the Indian papers about how he had written a, because he was very friendly with Prince Philip in those days, and Prince Philip had come to Jaipur, where my father was commanding the regiment, and he came to his home. They played polo together. So it was basically his whole love for the game, and the only thing he knew was horses. So he said he'd rather begin a career in horses than in anything else, and that's what brought him to horses.
And when you were growing up, was it always your destiny to do this, to take this on?
Well, not really. I was a bit of a rebel. Of course, because we were in the army, we all rode in the morning, and I competed in show jumping and so on, dressage and various other horsey activities. But at the age of about 14, I decided to rebel, and I said, no, I'm not going to do this. But I think it possibly was in my blood, because after the few teen, you know, you say the horrible teens, when you want to do the opposite of what your father is doing or your parents are doing. When I turned 23 and 24, I joined my father, and I realized that really this was what was attracting me, and he made a deal with me where I joined him in the farm, and he sent me off for training abroad.
And so where did your training take you?
Well, the first place I went to was the Irish National Stud, where I did the stud farm management course, I must say. In India, we don't have a culture of such hard work. We have a lot of staff here. So I had blue feet and had a sore eye, but I managed quite well. I did a project on stallion selection, which really stood me in very good stead later. And then from there, I went to Kentucky to do my equine nutrition course. I studied under Joe Pagan and Steve Jackson, actually their foremost nutritionists, and they told me when I was living with them that this was the only time they were going to give have a student come and stay with them, because I was stealing all their secrets. But so I had, yeah, these were the two places that I actually went and studied, you know, horse management and horse feeding.
And you came back to India. How quickly did you then enjoy success with your father?
Well, I have to say, I came back in 1992 after the Irish National Stunt, the stint there. And then I joined my father in 1993 after the Kentucky placement. And I have to say that within 4.5 years, I produced my first Indian Derby winner in indictment, my Razin. My father had bought this amazing stallion in 1992 called Razin. He was a son of Northern Dancer, and he really changed the landscape of Indian breeding and Indian racing. He's even till today, he's probably one of the, you know, breed shapers in the industry as far as a stallion is concerned. And I was determined to produce a top class horse, because my father had said, I was in a very meager salary, and he said, if you can produce me an Indian Derby winner, I will treble, or I don't know what, he was going to really give me a massive salary. And I thought, well, that is worth working for. And he thought that it would take me at least 8 or 10 years, but I did it in 4.5.
And then, Amita, your life was to completely change in 2001. Just for those who aren't familiar, just explain what happened to you.
Oh, well, yes, it did change. In 2001, about after 9 years of being at the stud farm under the guidance of my father, I lost my family in a helicopter crash in India, in a hill station. My mother, my father, and my sister were in the same helicopter, and it crashed in very unusual circumstances. One of the strange things that happened, and one day my entire destiny changed. I was left alone with the reins of not only Usha Stud, but having to cope with a tragedy that I don't think words can explain what took place.
Words can't explain it, and there is no one listening to this who will be able to really have any comprehension of what you were going through at that time. Try and tell me a little bit about how the business, how the stud, and about how horses carried you through that time.
Well, I have to say that I was, you know, I was in two minds whether I would be able to really take on the full management and reins, because my father was doing all the selling and all that, and I was doing the background work of managing the stud farm. And frankly, though I was interested, I wasn't as passionate as he was at that point. And I had double minds, you know, whether I should continue or not. And I wasn't sure whether I was going to be able to succeed in the way that he had succeeded. And so I was in a very strange place of being extremely caught. And then when I went to Bombay for the Indian Oaks, which happened to be about 10 days later, I just, you know, got on back to work. A lot of people met me, and I remember that one of my competitors, the biggest stud farm, and, you know, one of the biggest, they came up to me and he shook my hands and he said, oh, I suppose you're going to close down now. You won't be able to manage the stud farm after your parents, obviously, you know. Do you have a cousin or a brother that can help you out? Mm-hmm. And this sort of thing went on a bit, you know, a couple of times with, you know, at different moments. And I think my blood started boiling, and I just, you know, went stone cold. And I think it was at that point that I decided to take up the stud farm seriously. And I said, no, I think I will be able to manage. Thank you so much. Then there was a hostile bid to buy over my farm by some of my competitors. And that made me even more steely. And then the third thing was that I began to sell my horses, and they said, you can't demand the prices your father did. He was a very good marketeer. So they made a cartel against me the following year, some of my buyers. I said, we won't buy from her, and obviously she's going to bring down her prices. And I just went through that like steel. It's like, you know, something just, you know, I think what got me through was that I thought to myself, nothing can be as bad as what I've gone through. So if I went through that, this is nothing. So I just stayed put. I didn't change my prices. I refused to budge. But I was very quiet and still. And suddenly everything just opened up for me. And I won the Indian Oaks that year when I went to Bombay amongst a lot of cheering. The entire crowd was with me. And, you know, after that, the next year, after my father passed away in 2003, I won the Indian Derby again with a horse that I owned myself and bred called Psychic Flame. And it was like raining success. It was all the fruits of the quiet labor that had gone into the farm that started paying up. And, you know, the whole farm started building up, and there was just success after success after success. And I, you know, there's no words to describe it.
And you're doing, and you have done, his and your family's legacy, unbelievably proud. I want to ask you about Multidimensional, and can you just give me an idea of the impact that he's had since you've stood him?
Yes, he's been, I think, the, you know, champion stallion since the day, since the first year he came to India. He was freshman sire, champion sire, then he became champion stallion for 6 years, except for 1 year in between. And he is again this year, once again, the champion stallion of India. He's been phenomenal. He's been quite a breed shaper. His daughters are now back at stud. He's produced the Indian Derby winner this year called Immortality, which I incidentally own and, you know, ran in my own colors. He produces 60% of the black type and graded races in the country every single year. I would say that, you know, he's probably the Galileo of India.
And speaking of Galileo, I wanted to talk a little about Deauville, because people often wonder what happens to some of the horses who excel globally and they're not standing in the UK or Ireland or France. They're sort of slightly out of sight, out of mind. And we can happily say that Deauville is about to embark on a pretty exciting career.
I would say so. I think with the kind of broodmare band that I've, you know, we've got, and it's like, you know, it's almost like wine growers. I've been nourishing families and you know, daughters and granddaughters and great granddaughters and great great granddaughters of classic winners, and the idea of bringing Deauville in this year to cover our mares is the next step for me is to go global, is to go to South Asia. And my dream is to have an international carnival kind of event and invite, you know, horses from different countries to come and compete here. And likewise, I think Deauville will bring in a certain quality. He'll add something to the Danehill blood. And as you know, there's a fabulous nick between Galileo and Danehill. So I imagine that, you know, I'm preparing myself to see if I can add a little bit of, you know, what should I say, interest in trying to race and take my horses abroad to race, and also to bring in some international flavor into Indian racing.
Well, we've talked so much on this podcast about how we can, you know, increase the globalization of the sport, try and cross-pollinate all enjoy each other's racing and each other's cultures. And it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. And given what you've already achieved, Amita, I have absolute confidence that your next goal will be realized before too long. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much, Nick.
My thanks to Amita Mehra and, of course, to Fergal O'Brien and to Joseph O'Brien earlier in the show. Lee, I think it's fair to say that Amita has had an extraordinary journey, and it's wonderful to hear that she's doing so well with her stud in India now.
Yeah, what an incredible story, Nick. Obviously, with a particularly heartbreaking, tragic chapter in it, and the way she has fought back from that, and the way she has fought back from the sexism subsequently presented to her, I think paints her as a remarkable lady, and all power to her.
Let's get a tip for today.
Tip for today, Nick. I am going to go in the opening race at Epsom Down, the fastest 5 furlong track in the sport. Dark Shot has run some really good races up Epsom's 5 furlong sprint track, and under Holly Doyle, I'm hoping he can win the 5 furlong handicap at 1:45. Dark Shot for me.
Lee, thanks so much. Thanks to all my guests. Thank you for listening. That was Tuesday, April the 20th. We'll be back to do it same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you in association with Fitzdares, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary.